Yes, Alfred?
To the bat phone, sir.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
It's Batman!
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to a supplemental episode of Batmania 66. Holly is not with us, as always, because Holly is on her honeymoon. Yay for her.
Yay!
She is on a boat in the Mediterranean, I think, right now.
I think she's in Greece right now.
Is she in Greece? Yeah. And with us is Nick coming back to help out.
Hello, hello.
So Nick and I decided, well, I decided, and Nick came along for the ride, that what we would do instead is, because it is the 25th anniversary of Batman the Animated Series, we would go back and watch the Beware the Gray Ghost episode of Batman the Animated Series. Nick, who apparently had not really watched Batman the Animated Series before.
Never. When I was growing... First of all, I'm so sorry. I just want to throw out there, I will only answer to Holly today because I feel like I am her replacement.
No, Tammy is Holly's replacement. I'm sorry. That's okay. Already been dubbed.
Damn it. You can call me Tammy. I'm fine with that, too. Yeah, when I was growing up, I, for some reason, in my mind, had assumed that cartoons with adult characters and, like real-looking people...
And drama
were adult, and that I just shouldn't be watching those. So I never really got into things like any sort of, like, DC animated... or any kind of anime or anything like that. It just was never a thing. Like, I was a Scooby-Doo kid, Hanna-Barbera all the way.
Okay, so the coming one from that perspective, because I grew up just mired in all of this and loved it. What was your first impression after watching the episode?
Oh, well, you know, there's a couple of things. Part of me is really kicking myself because I didn't watch it, because... and this might be going too far towards the story, but I actually thought the story of this episode was genius for about 10,000 different reasons.
This is an Emmy award winning show on that, multiple levels, multiple times, and it's not surprising.
Completely makes sense. And the animation style looked really great. I thought it looked beautiful. I did think it was a little odd that, I thought the pacing was really weird.
Yeah, this episode in particular, I think, crammed a lot of story into 24 minutes or whatever it actually is. The pacing's better on a lot of different episodes, but this one, for a lot of reasons, and obviously we're talking about it because Adam West guest stars as the titular Grey Ghost.
Yeah.
But for me, this episode was kind of a touchstone episode because as a kid, I used to watch the reruns of the 66 show, so it was super cool to me as a kid when Adam West's voice started coming out of that cartoon, because I was already in love with this, what to me was this revelatory version of Batman that really shaped, because it happened in 92, obviously, because it's 25 years. And when it came out on the heels of Batman Returns. So, for the first two seasons, the Penguin is that kind of movie version of the Penguin with the three-finger flipper hands and that sort of thing.
Penguin army and everything, too? Or just...
I don't remember if he had the actual army of penguins, but the design of the character was very much from the movie.
Okay.
And I liked this Batman universe way better than I ever liked Tim Burton's universe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because it was episodic and I got to see more of it and it got a chance to be more fleshed out, maybe that's part of it. But also I think that Bruce Timm and Paul Dini and Alan Burnett, who were kind of the creative drivers behind the show, and Randy Rogel and a whole bunch of other amazing people, were more in love with the character and what the character could be. Whereas I think Tim Burton was... putting his mark on the character.
Right, right.
Whereas I think Alan Burnett, Tim Burton, Alan Burnett, Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, Randy Rogel, I think those people were coming in to service the character with their talents as opposed to molding the character into something of theirs.
Yeah, because you're absolutely right. I feel like the Tim Burton Batman movies feel exactly like a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah.
More than they feel like a Batman movie. And... I have to be honest, like, I know enough about Batman, I feel like, to survive, but I don't feel like I know, I'm not an expert like you, but I would even go so far as to say, like, I mean, and like, Schumacher had the same problem, right, with his two movies, where they were more like Joel Schumacher movies than they were Batman movies, even though they were kind of linked, I think, in his mind to Batman 66.
Yeah.
But, I mean, And I know this is going off topic, but were the Nolan Batman movies, to me, those felt like, I mean, Nolan's stamp is there, but those feel like they service the character, especially the first two. Is that correct?
And what's so funny about the Nolan movies is that whereas Schumacher, and it's actually very funny, I was a guest on The Best of Two Evils, a podcast where they take two horrible things and each one of the hosts, Ben and Steve, who were on our podcast last episode, or episode before, each of them picks one of those things and has to defend it to a guest judge. So I was the guest judge when they talked about who was... they tried to defend Uma Thurman as Poison Ivy and Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze. And we talked about the fact that Schumacher set out to make a cartoon. He actually told people, we're making a cartoon here.
That makes sense.
And he set out to make something that was like the 66 show, with that kind of wackiness. But what he missed is that the whole movie is constantly winking at the audience about how wacky it is.
Right.
Whereas none of it's grounded. And if you look at the Nolan movies borrow heavily from Batman 66. Things like the mask that the Joker wears in Dark Knight
mm-hmm.
is the same mask that Cesar Romero, or the same mold
mm-hmm.
that Cesar Romero wore when Joker sang Pagliacci on 1966. And there's lots of other little nods, including the end of Dark Knight Rises was the third one, right?
Yes, that's correct.
The end of Dark Knight Rises is a two-minute scene of Batman desperately trying to get a bomb out of the city.
Yeah.
The Batman 66 movie, the whole, one of the biggest things to come out of that is Batman running around Gotham with a giant bomb.
Trying to get...
And the closing line, literally, of some days you just can't get rid of a bomb. That is the ending of Nolan's Batman trilogy.
Well, I do have to say, though, that it's funny that you say the biggest thing to come out of the Batman 66 movie was...
Well, bomb. Okay.
It's the shark repellent
bat spray is the biggest thing to come out of the movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, so getting back to this and to the what's referred to as the sometimes as the Deanie Tim universe.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm just gonna go back for a second because that's just what did you? I have a theory of like what I think was worse, Uma Thurman or Arnold Schwarzenegger. What was yours? What was your conclusion?
So. This was my closing statement. We actually closed the podcast on this. When people watch Batman and Robin, nobody wins. So normally what they do is they do a 3-point scale. Argument one is serious points. State my case, opening statements. In that particular instance, Steve, who was arguing for Uma Thurman, lost himself his argument because he had a friend who was a... laser expert. Literally, had a doctorate in laser science.
This feels like a Batman villain, a laser expert.
I'm not kidding. He called in. He had his friend call in. This guy is complete with a Russian accent. Laser scientist. Like, the perfect supervillain. Called in, and Steve called him in to debunk all of the needing a diamond and freeze gun and all that. And also to say that if Mr. Freeze had just patented, he would have gotten all the money that he wanted.
Yeah.
However, what his laser scientist friend ended up doing was confirming that everything Mr. Freeze was doing has a basis in science, including diamond-focused lasers, where using the laser would corrupt the diamond so that you would need a steady stream of diamonds to keep it running. My mind was blown.
I feel like... My own sensibility of what is right and wrong is now betrayed.
Exactly.
By knowing this information.
It was absolutely just a total mind warp of, are you serious? This is realistic? What is going on? And even the fact that we're not to the point where we can cool something at room temperature, but cooling lasers actually exist as well.
What?
Yes. I suggest The Best of Two Evils. I suggest you go listen to the Batman and Robin episode because we get into it in real depth. But it was so mind-blowing. We didn't do a second round because we took way too long with the guest. So I gave myself the middle point. So at that point, it was Mr. Freeze 1, me 1, Poison Ivy 0. And then they do a third round. The third round is ad hominem attacks, where they just cable news show yell at each other. I ended up giving that point to Poison Ivy because Poison Ivy successfully, Steve successfully argued the point that Poison Ivy's motive was to save the planet. Mr. Freeze's argument was to save one person and to potentially to kill an entire city just for his wife. So altruism won the day in the third round.
That makes sense.
So it was a tie.
That makes sense.
So nobody wins.
Nobody wins.
But
nobody.
Yes, mind blown, the fact that cold lasers exist.
I can't even handle this.
Yeah.
I can't even. I feel like we should just stop recording for like 10 minutes. So
calm down, reset.
Yeah, just my brain can get like packed back into my head after it melted out.
But getting back to this episode,
yes.
Beware the Gray Ghost. The premise of the episode is that crimes are being committed in Gotham that mirror an old episode of a TV show that Bruce Wayne used to watch as a little kid.
And what was really great... I'm so sorry. Should we...
Should we just jump right in?
So what I thought was really cool about that actually was... It actually opened with the serialized version.
Yeah.
And for somebody who had never seen the animated series before, at first I almost turned to you and asked, like, is this always sort of presented in the serialized version?
Yeah, because it starts as like a real, like a movie serial with the narration in black and white. And it's very much, not even 60s style. It's very much 40s style.
40s style, yeah.
And so it starts off with a chemical factory being blown up.
A plastics factory.
Plastics factory, pardon me, yes. Plastics factory being blown up, and the Gray Ghost getting a ransom note saying that the bank is next, give me $1 million.
And we cut straight to Gotham.
Yep.
Mirroring that, where the plastics factory of Gotham, although it is weird that they both have plastic factories, but that's all the story, blows up, and with Batman getting the note. And it was actually seamlessly cut together, where at first I was really like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, in a really great way, like...
If you don't... Especially, I guess, if you don't know what's going on, it looks like it's repeating itself.
Yeah, but in a really smart
way.
Like, it was really well put together. To the point where I actually started thinking, like, if you wanted to move away from, like, big explosion superhero, and you wanted to do, like, a stripped down, like, actual detective comics, Detective Batman, like, this would be... Like, if you wanted to remake that as a movie, you use this plot.
If you get a chance to watch the show, you'll see that that's one of the things that they do very well, is giving Bruce Batman an actual chance to be a detective as well as a crime fighter.
Interesting.
And there are episodes that are dedicated to mysteries as opposed to just fighting the Joker or whatever.
Well, that makes sense, too, because in a lot of the... It felt very film... Like, not only did the serial have that film noir thing going on, but the actual... The world of Gotham sort of had the shadow and, like, half-face, and it felt very noirish, which, I mean...
Yeah, we were talking about this. I was mentioning to Nick that one of the things that I remember very much so from when the show was first launched was watching a behind-the-scenes special where one of the animators was talking about the fact that the show's backgrounds, for the first time in a Saturday morning cartoon, a major one, the show's backgrounds were all drawn on black paper because the palette of the show was so dark that it didn't make sense to start with white and have to color everything in. So they started on black. And in this episode in particular, one of the things that does is the serialized Gray Ghost episode is black and white.
So good.
Looked beautiful. But also when you go into that sort of repetition in the real world of Gotham, quote-unquote, the only thing you really see different is that yellow comes into it from the street lamps.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It looks almost exactly like the same shot.
These weird hints of color. And the only other thing, too, is it would... I wish I remembered the name of the town that the Gray Ghost took place in.
Yeah, I don't recall.
But, the name difference, too. And that was one of those things where, like, I almost had to actually step back and remind myself, like, oh, right, that's... One is Gotham and one is the other city, which I just thought was really smart. Yeah.
And so this explosion happens. We already know it's a Gray Ghost plot because we've seen the bit of the serial and seen Bruce watching it with his father. And we see Bruce get taken to bed before the end of the episode, which, of course, is kind of amazing. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And... So Batman gets the note, and he's kind of staring at it, can't quite figure it out. And we cut to Bruce in his sleep, waking up and realizing this is the show that I used to watch.
Yeah.
And he sets out to try and find the episode, which apparently is nowhere to be seen. This is also an episode that's a love letter to nerds. It's a love-hate letter to nerds.
Yeah, I thought that. Like, the one like, the chubby guy at the movie, like, the video rental store.
Yeah.
It was like a direct slap to Kevin Smith's face.
Well, and this is sort of pre-Kevin Smith.
No, I know that, but I mean, yeah. Still, like...
Well, and what I feel like is this is sort of... knowing what I know about some of the writers on the show and knowing some people who worked on the show, I feel like this is sort of them staring in a mirror darkly.
Okay, good, because when I saw that guy, I was like, oh, man, why am I on this episode?
Right. And so Bruce and Alfred go to this warehouse store, essentially, and ask the guy, where can, you know, I'm looking for a TV show. He goes, I got everything. I'm looking for The Grey Ghost. And he explains, can't have it. Everything it doesn't exist. That. Because apparently the studio burned down 20 years ago.
And that was at a time, and this is a movie nerd thing, of like where they would probably be using nitrate film.
Mm-hmm.
And nitrate is highly, 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 highly flammable to the point that they don't use it anymore. They use the celluloid because otherwise. So it would make sense that any remaining stock of that, if there was fire near it would go up like...
Like kindling, like, yeah.
Kindling, yeah.
And, well, and the other thing, of course, is I get the feeling... And this is, again, a film nerd thing. I get the feeling, the way it was talked about in the show, that The Grey Ghost was a film serial that was then rebroadcast on television.
Yes.
Because they mentioned negatives, and they mentioned a few things that make me think of that.
I feel like you're right.
Because a television show at the sort of time that was indicated by the television that Bruce was watching and the style of it, it would have maybe been a kinescope. There wouldn't have been negatives of it.
That's right. I think you're right in that.
Which is... film nerdy like crazy.
So nerdy.
But so the negatives went up, and Bruce then tries to figure out what's the next step. He goes to the Television Actors Guild.
Yeah.
And he looks up the actor. And meanwhile, we're seeing...
Goddamn, if they only had IMDb,
yeah,
it would take like 12 steps for Bruce.
But they look up the actor, and... We see him, he is down on his luck, he's in a crappy apartment, the landlord is pounding on his door for the rent, and this is in 92, this is a point that you were going to make, you didn't say it, but I can tell you were going to make it, this is when we hear Adam West for the first time.
No, the second time.
Second time, because we hear him as the Grey Ghost.
As the Grey Ghost.
That's
and,
right.
And I think you know the point I'm going to make, which it's really interesting.
In that in 92...
In 92, Adam West was probably in a very similar position.
Yeah. Because this is before Family Guy, before his resurgence. Family Guy was like 99.
Yeah, and I don't even know if he was on until like 2000, 2001.
No, he took a couple years to get on, because I actually, after he passed away, I heard an interview with Seth MacFarlane, or I read an interview with Seth MacFarlane, who was talking about the fact that they, in the episode with the Quahog... Clam Fest, or their first town festival.
Yeah.
They were trying to figure out, well, who should the mayor be? And somebody went, what about Adam West? And they went, that's great, but who would he play? And the writer went, no, Adam West. And it was one of the best decisions that they ever made on that show.
Yeah, like,
that was
actually.
That was really the mark of him coming back in the huge way and becoming a cultural figure again.
Yeah, well, I think that people largely forgot about him, which I thought was, I mean... I mean, it must have in some ways really sucked for Adam West, but mm-hmm. like the mimicking of like this guy who was a hero to kids, who was a superhero in his own right, and Grey Ghost is sort of modeled, it feels like, on like the spirit or like
definitely.
You know, something like that, and then just having, I just was so, that was actually one of the things that felt so brilliant about, like, it was an inspired choice to reach out to Adam West
mm-hmm.
to voice that character, because Bruce is going through the exact same thing I feel like you and I would have gone through as kids watching that moment of like, oh my God, that's the guy. That's that's my hero
but
guy.
But also, you think about it, and that's what, again, that's what the writers were going through in that moment.
That's true.
They were, this was the first season of this show. They were just getting started. It's a 9-month lead time for an animated show like this, so they didn't know kind of what else was going to happen with it. Is it going to hit? Is it going to miss? And I I'm going to go out on a limb and talk for people that I don't have authority to talk for, but I'm sure this episode was definitely a love letter to Adam West.
Oh, it had to have been.
And I'm sure that they set out when this episode was written, and it was like, we want to get him because we want to tell him how much his version of Batman informed us and made us the people we are, the writers we are.
And that's the thing that, I mean, and we'll eventually get there I'm jumping ahead, but like, the last few moments of the episode, like, I felt myself get a little like...
Yeah.
Like, oh...
There's actual emotion in the episode. Yeah.
Yeah, like,
and that's the thing about Adam West in this as well. I showed Nick the trailer for Batman versus Two-Face, the next 1966 animated movie that's going to come out with William Shatner as Two-Face. And we're talking about the fact that in the trailer you can tell that Shatner is not doing a Shatner impersonation.
No, not at all.
He is really showing up for the character and servicing the character. The same with Adam West in this. Adam West has the Adam West voice. He can't not.
Right.
But he's not doing a Batman 66 Adam West caricature. He's acting the part, and he's acting the part extremely well. And that's another thing in the episode, and I think, aside from the fact that, yes, Adam West had, if he wasn't still going through that period of his career, had gone through that period of his career, this was also the point in time where Fox and Warner Brothers... We're starting to really fight over the rights to the 1966 show.
Oh, interesting.
And it got locked up for a very long time. So I think the talk of the show being lost is specifically pointed
to because that. Huh.
The show only got released on Blu-ray and DVD 2.5-3 years ago now.
Right.
It took a long, long time to settle those rights issues. And that was, I think, part of it. So this character, obviously this character is based on Adam West and is going through the same problem that Adam West had to deal with, which is I am so inextricably tied to this character. Nobody can see me as anything else, but that material is now being shut away in a way that it's not paying my bills and I can't get it out.
And help me on this one, because I was actually thinking about it during the episode. Other than Family Guy... And maybe some weird, just like out like very, very small, like cameo kind of appearances. Is Adam West, like, did he have any other like big starring things, or did he show
up?
He did
a lot of really bad movies. There's at least one movie called Zombie Nightmare, which ended up on Mystery Science Theater. He did at least one of the Happy Hooker movie series. Like, he did...
God.
He showed up in a lot of very either low-rent or low-class things because it was the only type of things that he could get.
Yeah.
And it is...
And he was there for the novelty aspect of it, not the real...
He needed a paycheck, and they hired him because Adam West is a name that people would know.
Right. Okay.
And it's too bad because he is definitely one of those people who was better than he ever got credit for.
You know who he kind of reminds me of in that same vein? And I think he got a lot more credit early in his career, but towards the later part of his career, he was kind of known for one thing, and that's Leslie Nielsen.
Yep.
Where, like, her early career, you see him in things, you're like, oh, shit, this guy is good-looking, he can act, he's got all the right pieces, and then all of a sudden, Airplane, Naked Gun... And then it's nothing but Spy Hard and Scary Movie.
But much like Adam West, it was a shorter doldrum.
Yeah.
Because he went from... Leslie Nielsen was one of the people who guest spotted on everything in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And then he got to Police Squad and Naked Gun in the 80s. So he got Airplane, Police Squad, and Naked Gun into the 80s. He got lucky in that aspect because his career was hitting the skids. Because he was getting older, and he was kind of a niche, the guest spot actor. He was no longer considered any kind of a leading man.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he latched onto that and got to that was very lucky for him. And again, like Adam West, it wasn't until somebody gave him the opportunity to play a caricature of Adam West that his career took off again.
I read this really interesting story, and I know this is Leslie Nielsen, but the reason he got cast in Airplane and Police Squad... was the fact that he didn't understand the script was a comedy, and he came in and he played it so super straight that was exactly what they were looking for, and that was part of like the gold is like he didn't find it funny,
yeah,
and that's what made it so funny.
Yes, well, and there's stories like that all over the place. We're going to hit one more digression, and then we're going to head back to the podcast.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm really bad at this.
But no, no, that's what they're there for. But when Blazing Saddles was made, Mel Brooks wrote the theme song to Blazing Saddles. And he said to the producers, his other producers, I really want like a Frankie Lane sort of voice. They got Frankie Lane. Nobody told Frankie Lane that the movie was a comedy and a spoof on Westerns. That's why the theme is as good as it is, because Frankie Lane thought this was a serious Western movie that he was singing the theme song to. So that is again, and okay, I'll tie it right back. The problem with Joel Schumacher and what he made versus 1966.
I see where you're going.
Is that as wacky as the 66 show was, and everybody involved knew how wacky and silly and strange it was, in the moment, every one of those people is living in that universe.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's true of the animated series as well. Even the moments that are winks to the audience, the characters aren't winking, the show is winking.
The show is winking. And it's done in a way that feels... Well, it's the story in and of itself is serving the story in and of itself,
yeah.
Right? Where Schumacher wasn't serving the story, he was putting a pause on story to come out.
And do these different things,
and
yeah.
Yeah, look at us and go, get it, in case you didn't get it.
Right.
Get it?
Yeah, isn't it cool how cartoony we're being?
Yeah.
And so...
People are smarter than that, and people... Like, even kids... I mean, I remember watching those movies, and I was younger, and thinking, this is shit.
Yeah. And but in this episode, so Grey Ghost is down on his luck, mirroring what a lot of people assume Adam West was going through, at very least from the exterior, what his career was going through, whether or not he ever had those money problems, I don't know, none of my business, but his career was definitely in the toilet at the time.
Yeah.
And we see that. Grey Ghost collects all his stuff and goes to his local collector's toy store.
Uh-huh.
Might as well be comic shop, but whatever. Collector's toy store.
I wish that existed in real life. That place looks so cool.
Yeah, definitely looked cool. But he goes to sell the last of his remaining memorabilia.
Yeah.
And the guy says, I'll take it, but I can't give you much. And you see that all that stuff is on sale. And again, it goes back to the fact that he's tarred by the legacy of the Grey Ghost, but he can't. The Grey Ghost can't be a thing because nobody can watch it.
Yeah.
And he goes back to his now empty apartment, tells his Grey Ghost poster, which is the last bit of memorabilia he has left, that's the last time he's paid for the rent.
Oh, which was
And he a falls great asleep moment. In his living room chair in the most depressing way. Like it is 50-50 if you've never seen that episode.
I thought he was going to die.
Yeah. 50-50 that
I was half concerned. I was like, no, they're not. This can't be. This cannot be a thing that happens.
And when he does wake up in the morning, all of his Grey Ghost stuff is back. And there's a little note pinned to his original Grey Ghost costume that says, meet me at 3rd and whatever.
In front of the library.
Or in,
the
bank, yeah. Right? And in front of the bank. Sign a friend.
And I just want to say, too, that I actually thought that was a really cool reveal. Where he opens his eyes and it's all sitting there and he's sort of surprised. And I thought what was interesting about that, just the way they did it, is there was a moment where I questioned, like, oh, was that a dream or is this the dream?
Right. Yeah, it doesn't seem real.
Yeah, and there was just something lovely about the way it happened, because I think the bad version would have been, we see Batman sneak in and put all the stuff
right
there. Which I think just goes to, like, how well that moment was written.
I like the idea of Batman as Santa Claus. I mean, but, which is what it was.
Which is what it was.
But showing it would have been huge overkill.
Yeah.
And we get to the Grey Ghost, who's the actor's Trent something or other. Something Trent.
Trent Stewart Trent? Trent Stewart?
Something. He's standing by the bank. And Batman comes out of the light of a lamppost. And justifiably, the Grey Ghost freaks out. Starts running. Batman catches up to him and explains he needs his help. Because he can't remember the episode.
Yeah.
And as he's explaining that, we hear the little whining noise that precedes the explosions. Batman pushes Trent into an alleyway.
Actually, first, I think Trent goes, oh, God, that noise.
Something like that, yeah.
And then Batman pushes him into the alleyway.
And the bank explodes. And, sorry, I'm looking up what the character's name was, because it's going to bug me.
Well, I'll kind of continue there for a second. So the bank explodes, and Batman is very much like, I need your help. And the Grey Ghost is like, no, I'm not going to help you. And he goes and walks away. He goes into his apartment. When he opens his apartment door, Batman is standing there, and he's like, I need your help. To which the actor, Trent something or other.
Yep. One sec. We'll find it.
Yeah. He opens up this case. And I thought this...
Simon Trent. That's what it is.
Simon Trent. I thought this was such a just like a really nice moment of like... Everything that he gave up, he still has all of those episodes on the old film reels, which goes to...
Well, in particular, sorry, before the old film reels, he gets back into his apartment. He's still carrying this box that we haven't seen the interior of.
When
Batman appears, he drops the box, and we see that Simon Trent was going to give that original costume to whomever it was who brought his stuff back to him.
Oh, interesting. Was that the interpretation?
That's what I got from it.
Oh, because I had a slight interpretation that he says, I need you, I need your help, a friend.
Oh, you thought he was going to get into it?
I thought he brought it to get into it to maybe help something.
I don't know, because why wouldn't he be wearing it already if he was...
Maybe to check out what was going to happen, like the purpose?
Maybe.
Because, and the only reason I think that, and it wasn't in that moment that I thought that, it was later on when he shows up in the Grey Ghost outfit. As a superhero to help out.
See, I didn't... I saw that as sort of... Pardon the analogy, but I saw that as a Three Amigos moment.
Okay.
Like, he was not planning to be a hero.
Interesting.
He was planning to do something very nice for the person who gave him his legacy back.
I like that you said Three Amigos moment, by the way.
And was going to give it, but it was after this moment where he's challenged by Batman, and he gives Batman the film and says, here, this is the episode you're looking for. Don't ever come back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was after that that he realized, no, I have an obligation to find out what's going on and help, that he decided to put on the costume and become the Grey Ghost for real.
See, and I'm going to throw out there, though, and I'm going to use Three Amigos. I'm going to say the Three Amigos moment where I didn't think I didn't think he thought he was going to actually be a superhero. I think he was going to... He thought he was going to show up...
Oh, and do an event or...
Make some kids' day, kind of a thing.
Oh, that makes some sense.
Like, not... like the Three Amigos did, right? Where
okay,
they,
yeah.
So... either interpretation yes. works perfectly well.
Yeah, I see... Yeah, both absolutely work. But anyway, Batman gets the episode. He watches. Sees that the whining noise is made by remote-controlled cars loaded with explosives.
Mm-hmm.
He tells Commissioner Gordon, I guess it's not the bank, because they're at the bank the next scene where Commissioner Gordon and everybody's looking for the...
Yeah.
So I think
the library? I don't know.
Library, something.
Something like
another
that.
Another building.
Oh, no, it was the art studio.
That's what it was.
Gotham Art Studio that blew up.
Right, preceding the bank.
Preceding the bank, that's right.
So the SWAT team is at the bank. Batman is called, said, this is what you're looking for. The cars start coming. And... the police are able to shoot out the first car. Batman comes out with a friggin' flamethrower from the bank and takes care of the second one.
It's interesting because this is where the episode sort of, and pardon the expression, but like jumped the shark for me. Where
a little bit.
It went from really amazing detective story to, okay, now I can see this is a kid's show.
But it also went from looking at it as an adult and coming back to it, it went from like cool detective work to everybody's dead from these shockwaves.
I kept thinking there's the one point where the seven cars blew up underneath Batman, and this happens like right after, like Batman goes running after the third car, picks up the third car, finds out there's no bomb, and he's like, decoy. It sounded a lot like Will Arnett. That's why I asked you who
it is. Not was. Will Arnett is parroting,
yeah, parroting this
Kevin
guy.
Conroy, yeah.
Yeah. But he picks it up, he goes, decoy, and then like five cars come, Batman's surrounded, he's gonna die. And a rope drops, and he starts climbing up that rope, and the bombs start exploding underneath him. And I thought to myself, like, that's not the way ropes work. That's not the way bombs work.
Exactly. But, you know, it's a comic book.
Yeah.
It's a kid's show. It's fine. And again, it is ridiculous if you look at it as a cold-hearted adult. If you just watch the show, it's very cool.
And if there is one thing that I am,
it's cold-hearted. It's
a cold-hearted adult.
But the rope drops, Batman climbs it, he gets to the rooftop where the rope was dropped from, and it is Simon Trent as the Grey Ghost, such dressed cool in shot. Full costume. Yeah.
Such a cool moment.
And it's him framed as... Oh, one of the things, sorry, from the very beginning of the episode that is so brilliantly mirrored from the serial to the real world of the show is the shot of Simon Trent as the Grey Ghost jumping off the rooftop and then cutting to Batman doing the same thing.
And all done in, like, a silhouette.
Yeah, all done in a silhouette. And so this is where Trent explains that he wants to see this through. He wants to... He owes it to find out what's going on.
Yeah.
And they take the decoy, which Trent recognizes as real.
Uh-huh.
Because it's got the actual trademark Grey Ghost on the bottom.
Literally says Grey Ghost TM.
Yeah. And they try to get into the Batmobile, and they are cornered by a bunch more remote-controlled cars.
That's right.
Where Batman, not because of Batman, but Batman, in avoiding these explosions, blows up most of Main Street Gotham.
Yeah, just cars flipping over. There goes the movie
building
theater.
Fronts. Oh, God. It's, yeah. Carnage. Absolute carnage.
And they cut to that awesome shot of just, like, the city from above, and there's just a trail of smoke, like...
Yeah. Yeah, oh, it's...
It's fun. It's really fun.
It's great, and it's great television. But again, so much death.
I also thought to myself, too, because he sort of, like, does that classic, like, I'm gonna press a button, and oil's gonna shoot out, and it's gonna make all the cars, like, spin around. Yeah. And then they explode, and I thought was like, now you've just set oil fires everywhere.
Sorry, one thing that I loved about this show, and I'm going to backtrack a quick moment to after Bruce gets the film reel with the episode, and he's watching it in Wayne Manor, and Alfred offers popcorn. Him popcorn. And this is one thing that the show does really well, and you'll see this if you watch more of the show. It lets Bruce and Batman have little bits of joy.
Oh, yeah.
And so Bruce kind of robotically takes the popcorn and starts eating it, and immediately this little smile pops on his face, and it goes, does a close-up of his eye, and cuts to him as a little kid watching the same episode with his dad again.
Such
and
a
then,
nice moment.
And then back to Bruce as an adult still watching.
Such a cool moment.
And it is great to see Bruce... Even after this moment of having his hero worship destroyed by Trent not helping him out, see him get lost in that childlike enjoyment again for just that moment.
Yeah.
And again, going back to servicing the character as opposed to trying to make the character your own.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's this great moment of humanization and something realistic, because it's almost impossible to be as dour as some people portray Batman to be at every single moment.
And you know what's interesting, too, is when I think of Bruce... When I think of Batman and Bruce Wayne and Bruce Wayne's parents, I mean, really, the only thing I think about is the fact that they're dead.
You don't think about them as being parents.
Yeah, you don't think of the fact of them being parents, and that he was raised by these people until the age of 8, 9, 10,
something,
depending,
whatever it was, yeah, depending on who's telling the story.
And it was just really nice to... To the point, actually, I gotta be honest, when it first, even though the father was like, Bruce, you need to go to bed, it wasn't until the second time I was like, right, that's his father, and right, he was a human being, and Bruce was a child with a parent.
Yep.
Like, it actually took the second time for me to, like...
For that to sink in.
For that to sink in, of, like, it's not, they're not just dead beings that are plot devices, they are humans that live.
And that's something... that most Batman stories don't do very well.
Yeah. The only things that matter are that they died and that
and
they named
were
her
super
Martha.
Rich. Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
Slowly I turn, step by step, inch by... Sorry. Which would have been a much better ending for Batman versus Superman. Bruce takes Simon Trent back to the Batcave. And they get there, and we cut to Simon Trent taking off the blindfold that Bruce made him wear. And Simon Trent freaks out because it's exactly like the Grey Ghost Slayer from the TV show. He says it's almost an exact replica.
Mm-hmm.
This is a moment where they do a Batman 66 nod that I did not get as a kid and just noticed now, and it is my favorite thing in the episode of an episode of one of my favorite episodes of the entire show. Batman analyzes the Grey Ghost's remote-controlled car by placing it on top of the Bat computer, which is what they do in the 66 show all the time, and I love every second of it. And Batman finds...
Well, and he just hits a bank of lights, too. Yeah. They have, like, no buttons or numbers or anything. Yeah. It's just like a bank of lights that look like an ice cube tray lit from underneath.
Yes. And it turns out that the fingerprints on the car are Simon Trent's.
Oh, sorry, because there was another cool moment that we skipped after Simon Trent is like, it looks just like the Batcave. Batman goes, you like that? Look at this. And he presses a button.
Oh, he's got his own memorabilia. Yeah. And this is where Batman explains to him, I used to watch the show with my father.
Yep.
The Grey Ghost was a hero.
It was a hero of mine. And it's just this really cool just memorabilia room of like a rabid collector of these things.
And it's this cool... Again, it is a humanizing moment of Bruce having... another sort of shrine to his parents,
yep.
but a positive one.
Yep, absolutely.
And that's the thing, is that it's this crystallization, this preservation of a positive thing about his parents. And that's, again, something else that most depictions miss.
Mm-hmm.
And when his parents are just a MacGuffin and a plot device.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he shows in the memorabilia room, then they find out that the prints are Simon Trent's. And that's where... Simon says, but I'm not the Mad Bomber. I sold those months ago. And that's when he realizes who the Mad Bomber must be.
Yeah.
And it's the guy who owns the toy store.
And it was a great moment, too, to let Simon... I gotta be honest, it was a great moment that, like, Simon Trent makes that discovery. Like,
yes.
He gets to be... He truly gets to be the Grey Ghost one more time.
Yeah.
I think I referred to him as Spirit earlier, but it's merely more like the Shadow. But anyways,
it's a lot of those.
Yeah, those kinds of things.
But yeah, but in particular, probably more the Shadow than.
But
because I kept wanting to call him Lamont Cranston when I couldn't think of the name. That's because that's who played the Shadow.
And I keep thinking to myself, the Grey Shadow, and I'm like, oh no, it's actually the Grey Ghost.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that was just a great. I mean, it was just a lovely. That was what was really nice about the thing is that like. Is it? I mean, again, it's that like if we keep stepping away and we think of Adam West getting to be a superhero again,
yep.
and in that moment we see the Grey Ghost getting to be a superhero again,
yes,
and a detective. Like that was, those moments are so meta and they're so beautiful the way they're actually like combined.
And again, it is this absolute love letter mm-hmm. to Adam West, and it is this interesting, and this is where we get to. Kind of the message of the episode, and honestly, the message of the episode is not hammered in, but the message of the episode is your passions can either build you up or destroy you.
Yeah.
And these two people who had similar exposures to these pop culture ideas, this toy man who becomes twisted, and we find out that his motivation is literally, he wants to blackmail and destroy so he can have more money just to
buy toys.
Feed his obsession with toys. And it is, that's your choice. Your passions either build you up or destroy you. And so we see that Batman took this germ of an idea that was put in as a kid and used it to do something arguably positive, because obviously Batman has his own psychoses.
Of course.
But, and this other person who, you know, had the same pop culture love and all that, let it consume him and let the things that he wanted take over and destroy his morality.
And what's really interesting about that, too, because that's really, I mean, that really ties back into the thing that we were talking about earlier when you think about, we were talking about the nerds and, like, how is the love-hate relationship with the nerds of just that, like, even the video store guy who was a nerd, but he seemed to have, like, the positive neutral.
Yeah, he seemed clearly to also be a businessman. There was a credit card commercial around the same time, I feel like, and it was a joke, and it was a fake commercial for, I think it was called like Dan's Toys or something like that, but this is Dan's Toys. My name's Dan, and these are my toys. And in the commercial, somebody's trying to buy them, and he refuses to let them, because those are his toys. And that's, I think, the difference between the toy store owner and the video store owner. The video store owner was clearly running a business, and I can get you the things you're looking for.
He was also making a sale, I'm pretty sure, as it was happening. Like, he made a sale somewhere else while Bruce...
Exactly, yeah.
The way that nerd culture keeps wrapping around, and, like, the nerd obsession keeps wrapping around.
And so they confront him. He corners Batman. When the Grey Ghost realizes who it is, and we cut to him, the toy shop owner is bashing a Batman toy into his computer console in anger.
Which was another moment where I was like, oh boy. Yeah. But still.
It fit the character, and exactly. It fit the moment.
Exactly.
And
he's a big child.
And Batman comes in, and it looks like Batman is cornered. And Batman makes some comment about it's time to put away your toys. And that's when Simon Trent, as the Grey Ghost, gets the chance to fly in through the window and knock out the bad guy. Which is, again, so cool that he gets that moment.
So fun.
So the toy maker is defeated. And we cut to a release party where Simon Trent is signing the new video collection of the Grey Ghost episodes.
Well, I think before that we actually cut to a news story that the Grey Ghost was the one who saved Gotham.
Yes, yeah.
Which then allowed,
with the help of
Batman.
And then we see the release party. And so the Grey Ghost, Simon Trent is signing the videos. And Bruce walks up and said, can you make it out to Bruce? And Simon Trent says, sure thing, he signs it. And as Bruce is walking away, he turns back and he says, you know, as a kid, I used to watch the show with my father. The Grey Ghost was a hero of mine. It's the exact same thing that Batman told him. And we get to watch... Simon Trent's recognition that Bruce is Batman, and that's the end of the episode. And it was, again, just such a wonderful love letter, because that was Randy Rogel and Alan Burnett and Bruce Timm and Paul Dini and all of those writers. That was them saying to Adam West, thank you. This is what you gave to us that we're now turning around and trying to give to other people. And it's so cool. We're at 51 years of Batman 66 and now 25 years of Batman the Animated Series. And we're seeing that kind of turning point where the creators who are not taking over, because a lot of those people are still writing these things. Bruce Timm is still making DC animated features and things like that. But we're starting to see creators come in who, in the same way that... Batman 66 was
an influence
was 26 years before animated series came out. Batman the Animated Series is now 25 years past. So those people are now coming up and taking on those characters and taking on that mantle. It's very cool to kind of go back and look at where those things came from and recognize that there's an episode of the cartoon Batman the Brave and the Bold, which was with Diedrich Bader as Batman.
And that's circa, like, what?
A few years ago.
Okay.
Like, less than 10. And it was a much sillier, kid-friendly show. Like, a kid's Batman.
The second you said Diedrich Bader was in it, like, it had to have been.
And it's not a bad show at all. And actually, Paul Dini wrote an episode with the character Batmite, which is a ridiculous character. Think the great Gazoo from Flintstones. And Batmite... at one point in this episode, is at a comic convention where a nerd is complaining about this version of Batman, that he's actually in the episode's total nerd meta moment. And in the episode, Paul Dini, through Batmite, explains that all versions of Batman exist in a spectrum, and no one version is more valid or less valid than another. And it's true. I mean, some of them are written better than others, and some are created better than others. But it's this idea that just because one thing is aimed at one audience or another, or done in a different style than another, doesn't mean it can't inform and inspire.
Absolutely. And, you know, a couple of thoughts on both of those that you're talking about. Just number one, it's interesting that the Tim Burton Batman was about the same exact time, 25 years ago, which puts probably the Schumacher Batman around 23, 22 years ago, somewhere around there?
No, a little later than that. But,
the first one.
Batman Forever.
And something fascinating just in that we're talking is how these two things are created simultaneously. They they live simultaneously, and some still influence heavily, and others do not quite influence heavily, or maybe they serve as a lesson in their own.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating that as these two things are living simultaneously 25 years ago, we are now in a space where, I don't know if you've heard this, I'm sure you have, but they are developing both a Joker movie,
mm-hmm.
Joker Harley Quinn movie with Jared Leto and Margot Robbie.
And a standalone Joker origin movie.
Without Jared Leto.
Yes.
A different character taking place in like a different version of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, too, that's sort of the plan for the new Batman. Is that doesn't take...
That's the director of the next Batman movie has actually come out and said that's not what he meant.
Okay.
What he said was that it would not include a ton of world building. It would still within the DC extended universe.
That makes sense.
But it would not be like a Marvel movie where there's tons of nods and stuff like
that.
Would be a Batman story.
I see.
But DC is pursuing that idea of... This is something actually DC has done a lot of in the comics world. They've done these stories that are called Elseworlds. They were dubbed Elseworlds stories.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was actually Gotham by Gaslight, which they're making an animated movie of. And it was Batman versus Jack the Ripper in the 19th century.
Oh, that's cool.
And it's a really kind of cool
really
story.
Cool.
Yeah.
If you do that, I want to be the guest.
And it's coming out this year. I think I've got it pre-ordered already. But it is that sort of idea where if DC can make that work, it's going to be very interesting to see that in a cinematic world.
I don't think they will.
No.
Be able to, but it could, the potential of it.
I think that where they're likely to falter is doing these stories outside of the DC cinema universe that are too close
to the DC
universe. If they did, and if they had the courage to do like a Gotham by Gaslight or a just like an off the wall, this is not the DC universe you've seen on film before sort of movie, I think that could work.
And I think the average movie-going audience is not used to the idea of... it's just plain and simple, really not used to the idea of multiple worlds happening at once.
Yeah.
We are just now getting to the point where I think we're used to reboots. Like, I remember
used to reboots, but also used to the idea of cinematic universes.
Well, that too. I was thinking very specifically of, like, I remember a lot of people, like, having a lot of guff over the idea of the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man becoming the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man, and people like almost being like, but the other one came out like 3 years ago, that doesn't make sense. But by the time Tom Holland Spider-Man came along, people were like, oh yeah, it's just how it's done.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's also, I remember, speaking of all the different versions of Batman and the Batman from around this time, I remember when Batman Forever came out, and there's a line in there where Val Kilmer says to Dick, Bruce Wayne says to Dick Grayson, the circus has to be halfway to Metropolis by now.
Mm.
I remember my brother and I losing our shit over the idea that they had just acknowledged that Metropolis exists in this universe.
Yeah.
Because the idea that Batman and Superman could ever meet on film was mind-blowing.
I don't know. It's still kind of mind-blowing in the fact that they did meet on film and that exists.
All right. The Batman stuff in that movie is really good.
The
Superman stuff in that movie is...
I agree.
The movie itself is shite. But
I actually thought Ben Affleck, surprisingly, was...
I was not surprised
fantastic.
At all. Fantastic. I was not surprised at all. And he's really good.
He's really good. But yeah, then everything else around it was like...
Yep.
A gigantic turd.
Yeah, except for Gal Gadot, who didn't belong in the movie, but was very good in what she was in.
Yeah, her like 8 seconds.
But yeah, so again, all of these interpretations exist in an equal state of validity in a vacuum. Once they're finished and we see the quality of them, then of course some are more valid than others. But the ideas of them are all equally valid because the character exists in a lot of different ways.
And I think too. Oh, and I was telling Ben. This was the other point I was going to make.
You were telling Ben.
I was telling Ben before the podcast, before we started rolling. My imaginary friend Ben sitting right here. Hello, Ben.
How many Bens do you? I'm. You're cheating on me.
I am. Actually, I just call.
I feel dirty.
Well, it's just I miss you, so I call everyone Ben now. Like, you're supposed to call me Holly, or Tammy, but that's a whole story. what I was telling Ben before is the reason I was introduced to the Batman 66 was because I had watched either... I can't remember if it was Batman Returns or Batman Forever. I feel like it was Batman Returns, because Batman Forever, I was probably too old to do this. But I remember watching that and being so obsessed with the idea of Batman and so excited about the more movies coming out that I actually started watching the Batman 66 show, and every single episode, I mean, I had a piece of paper, it was a lined paper, where I, like, had, like, columns of, like, villain, and, like, the villain's real name.
And then what they could do.
And then, like, I also even had, like, a checkbox. This is really bad. A checkbox of, like, they appeared in this Batman movie. They appeared in that one.
Oh, that's... I mean...
And then, like, databased it out to keeping a list of all the villains to think about, like, oh, this is how many movies are possible in the long run.
That's interesting. I mean, that's cool.
But it brought me... That was going to be the point. That's, like, it's interesting, like... This Batman, the Tim Burton Batman movies, which probably didn't survive as well as other things did,
yeah,
introduced me to Batman 66, which did survive in a different way, which then turned around and introduced me to other things. And it's fascinating that, I guess the point I was making is, like, they do all exist in at their own thing, and they're in different spectrums.
Yep.
But it's amazing how any of those spectrums can just bleed and introduce you and make you excited about the other things on that line.
Right, and it's amazing that... how things come around again.
Mm-hmm.
Because the 66 show, which at the time, at the late 80s, early 90s, when the Tim Burton movies were coming out, Warner Brothers was specifically, these should not be like Batman 66.
Right.
And it's interesting to see that what holds up and what holds up the most is Adam West in Batman 66, and it is Batman the Animated Series, which clearly takes...
Mm-hmm.
From 66, and I mean, if you need any further evidence, this episode is that love letter where yes. they're like, "You are our Rosetta Stone," and it's interesting to see how once you get the perspective of 25 years, 50 years, what falls away and what remains.
I wonder if part of that has to do with the idea that the 66, and especially the animated series. They are love letters who serve the story and who serve the purpose and who serve, like, the thing that they are creating without the creator's stamp, and it being the exact opposite with the Burtons and the Schumachers, where maybe part of the reasons those fell off is because people didn't think of those as Batman, they thought of them as Burton.
Tim Burton or Schumacher. It's entirely possible.
I'm curious.
Now, I have brought this up before, And I will bring this up again because this is one of my favorite fan hypotheses, is that the Joel Schumacher movies are the Batman movies that exist in Tim Burton's Batman universe. And that idea, if you look at it through that prism, even Batman and Robin, which is almost unwatchable, actually gets a lot better. Because then you get the idea of Bruce sitting in there just going... is this
what is happening?
Yeah, Michael Keaton's Bruce Wayne trying to watch this Batman movie and going, "What is happening?
Why did I sell the rights? Why did I sell away the rights?"
Right.
I actually had this really long argument with a friend, and I'm just going to throw this out there with you about the two Schumachers. Is that arguably Batman Forever is more disappointing than Batman and Robin because we were expecting something of quality, perhaps, and what we got was. Something else.
I've watched Batman Forever recently.
Uh-huh.
I think you're, in my opinion, you're on the right track. What makes Batman Forever more disappointing than Batman and Robin is that Batman Forever has moments.
Interesting.
And pieces that are very well done. And Val Kilmer is possibly the best live-action Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
And
I would also go, I'm sorry, but, like, Keaton was probably one of the best Batmans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it's interesting that...
what's his face? And
Clooney?
I think Jim Carrey...
Oh, okay.
Does a serviceable job as the Riddler. He would be better with a better script. And then Tommy Lee Jones is completely misdirected.
He hated Jim Carrey. I just read this article about, like... just despised any moment that they had to work with each other.
Interesting.
And like
this was also a period of time where I'm pretty sure that Jim Carrey was still coked out of his mind at every moment.
Well, that was actually it. That was one of the things, was that, like, Jim Carrey was, like, at this one level, and, like, Tommy Lee Jones would be, like, sitting at the lunch. Jim Carrey would come over, and he'd just be like, would you leave me the fuck alone? like, I cannot. You are too much. Would you just stop?
But again, yeah. So I can see that, because Batman and Robin was just a shit show from moment one to the final moment.
Yeah. Well, and part of that, too, is, like, I felt like... And again, I haven't seen these ones in a very long time, but in my brain at that point, I kind of knew that from Batman Forever that Batman and Robin was going to be a shit show.
Yeah.
That the fact that it was like, okay, I mean, I knew this was happening. I'm actually not disappointed. I'm getting exactly what I expected to get.
Right. Weirdly enough, this will go back to another pop culture obsession of mine. I sort of figured out what to expect at the time that Batman and Robin came out. Mystery Science Theater actually did a summer movie spectacular, one of the two that they did, and they watched the Batman and Robin trailer. And as they were ripping into it, one of the scenes in the trailer is Batman and Robin riding the doors of the space shuttle that they try to save at the beginning of the movie. And I think it was Crow, but I don't remember, one of the characters in the show pipes up and says, apparently they feel the need to drink from their wide mouth cans and do the do. And as a kid, seeing that sort of mentally prepared me for, oh, they're right. This is probably going to suck. But yeah, so there, I mean, tons of different interpretations. Animated series is definitely one that takes a more serious tone. It isn't afraid to be comedic, but it takes a more serious tone. And it is great that it's willing to go back and recognize
yeah.
those other characters and all that. So that's our supplemental episode.
Yeah.
Can
I add one thing? I know yeah. you were wrapping up, but I was thinking about this the whole time about pace, and something uh-huh. really interesting that I just,
yeah.
I think, connected for me is I found the pace to be really bogged down in the animated show. And I was thinking just now, like, if this was live action, I don't think I would have found the pace to be bogged down. It would have felt very real and naturalistic. So maybe the pace issue is a Nick issue and not an issue overall with the
maybe.
Show.
Maybe. I also wonder if maybe it's because this was designed for commercial breaks. And so you aren't getting the variation and sort of the break of the commercial between those segments. So you're not... Because it, like all TV with commercial breaks, the episode often takes a moment to reset after where the yeah. break was. And that may be part of the pacing as well.
It wasn't necessarily in that. There was just like a moment for like... So I think an example is like... we see a moment with Bruce and he's looking through the picture and he's like, I found it. And then it's a long moment of sort of like Alfred looking at him and him looking at Alfred. And then they sort of get up and go to the next moment. So that's more the pace. It wasn't the breaks, although the breaks did fall weirdly. But I understood like when it blacked out,
got it,
and came
yeah.
back up. But I'm assuming though in live action, and that's exactly what they were doing, was they were trying to almost mimic live action.
And so again, it goes back to sort of not your sort of feeling towards those more naturalistic cartoons.
Yeah, my inherent biases that.
That's interesting.
That's something that to struggle with later on, and now that I've caught myself doing
yeah.
this, like, to point that out.
And I wonder if you go back and watch more episodes of the animated series, if that same thing will
yeah.
come
or,
through.
Or does it move away? Sorry.
No, now, that's
now wrap
interesting.
Up. I just,
yeah.
That kind of popped in my head.
So, this was our supplemental episode. Again, Holly, happy honeymoon.
Yes.
We will see Holly, or hear Holly, when she comes back for, hopefully, the next episode, which will be Ethel Merman. And the Penguin together.
Oh. Why didn't that happen in real life?
I'm sure Burgess Meredith and Ethel Merman were boinking backstage, I'm sure. So if you want to follow the podcast, you can do so Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Batmania66. If you're enjoying the show, please comment on Facebook, leave us an iTunes review or a review on Podomatic.com. If you want to get a hold of us, it's batmania66mail@gmail.com, or you can email Holly directly at julietamor, cobonoandtheedge@gmail.com. Nick, is there anything you want to plug? Any of your social media or anything like that?
There's nothing to plug as of right now. Things that are happening, hopefully soon I can plug something. But if you please reach out to me on Twitter, at Nicholas C. Pappas.
And that's P-A-P-P-A-S.
That's correct. And thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, everybody. We will see you next time. Same bat time, same bat channel.